Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns over the air and online at koacountry1077.com and at lava1053.com. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha, good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. We're here every Sunday on Koa Country at 6:30 a.m. and on Lava 105.3 FM at 8 a.m. And you may listen to the podcast online at lava1053.com and at koacountry1077.com. Island Issues is sponsored by Hawaiian Ukulele and Guitar. Ohia trees are a major part of Hawaii Island's ecosystem, but they are under attack with a relatively newly discovered condition called rapid ohia death. Today, I will be talking with three experts who can tell us why ohia trees are important, what the threat is, what solutions, if any, are coming along to stop rapid ohia death. J.B. Friday is with the University of Hawaii College of Tropical Agriculture Extension Service with a specialty of tropical forestry and agroforestry. Good morning. Aloha, J.B.
Good morning. Aloha.
Lisa Keith is with the United States Department of Agriculture Research Service at the Daniel K. Inouye Pacific Basin Agriculture Research Center, also called PBARC, which is in Hilo. Good morning. Aloha, Lisa.
Good morning.
And Flint Hughes is with the USDA Forest Service Institute of Pacific Islands Forestry. Good morning. Aloha, Flint.
Aloha, Sherry. It's good to be with you.
I'm curious about what your individual roles and responsibilities are. And let me start with you, Flint. What do you actually do?
I'm a forest ecologist, and I conduct research with the U.S. Forest Service here in Hilo. I've been doing that for the past 16 years. And most of my work has focused on dealing with invasive species impacts on our native forests and species.
And JB, what is your area of responsibility?
I'm extension forester with the University of Hawaii. So I work with private landowners and public land managers and teaching people ways of managing their forests. I also do some research. And it was a lot on koa until this cropped up, and now I'm really focusing on ohia.
Lisa, you are with PBARC, the Pacific Basin Agriculture Research Center. What are your responsibilities, not just you personally, but what happens here at PBARC?
Well, I'm a research plant pathologist, so my program for the last 14 years has been really focused on biology detection and management of mainly fungal problems on agricultural crops, and trying to learn a lot about them to be able to actually manage or control them in an environmentally friendly and economically viable way for farmers. Overall, boy, there's a lot going on at our center, looking at invasive species, looking at quarantine measures, nematology, horticultural issues. We have a germplasm repository here. So it really is a research center for Hawaii and the Pacific Basin to answer a lot of agricultural issues with high impact.
Okay, let's start with what is the ohia tree and what contributions does it make to Hawaii's landscape and Hawaii Island? Why is the ohia tree important? Let's start with you, Flint.
The ohia tree is really our most prominent and our most common native tree species. It covers almost 1 million acres across the state, much of that on the Big Island, but across the other islands as well. It really occupies as many of the environmental conditions that we have on this island, from low wet rainforest to the cooler upper cloud forest to the dry forests on the Kona side and on the leeward sides of the other islands. It really is the foundation species for our native ecosystems. It's always the first flowering plant species to colonize young lava flows, and it forms the system, the ecosystem that all other native species really depend upon for their development. It's also present on the oldest islands, in the bogs of the oldest islands, Kauai in particular. It provides habitat for all of our native birds, innumerable native insects, and provides kind of the nurturing environment for all of our native plants as well.
The ohia tree is very important in Hawaiian culture as well.
It is, and we see a demonstration of that every year at Mary Monarch Festival. We know from cultural practitioners how important the species is, both in terms of lei and materials, and really the underpinnings of a lot of Hawaiian belief systems. I think cultural practitioners really feel that ohia is a member of their family, and they feel that profoundly.
The ohia tree has a flower on it, which is called the lehua. So is it called the ohia lehua or the lehua tree or the ohia tree? Because I've heard all of those terms used. J.B. Friday.
There are a couple other trees that are also called ohia, ohia'ai, the mountain apple, and also the syzygium on Kauai. So the lehua is the flower, the long hairs of the flower. So ohia lehua is the ohia tree, which has the flower, which is the tree we're talking about.
You mentioned, Flint, that there's about 1 million acres of ohia trees, most of it on Hawaii Island. Do we know how many acres on Hawaii Island or how many ohia trees there actually are?
The acreage is approximately 880,000 acres. Is that about right?
800,000
acres. And in terms of the number of trees, well, that represents millions of trees, tens of millions of trees across the island.
Just remind us, I know the ohia tree populates our watersheds. Why is a watershed important to any place, but certainly why is the watershed important to this island?
Our watersheds provide, first in terms of people living on the island, our watersheds really provide the clean, abundant drinking water that we all rely upon, not to mention the water that our native ecosystems in particular rely upon, our river systems, our riparian systems, our nearshore ocean environments, all really depend upon that supply of fresh water that ohia supplies us. We've seen in the past where we have lost our forests, well, we've lost that landscape's capacity to store as much water as it could. And so it's very important in terms of our ecosystem services, the resources that ohia provides beyond the habitat, beyond the biodiversity, but something as elemental as water. We really need to protect our forests for that very reason.
Okay, so what was the first sign something was wrong with the ohia trees? And J.B. Friday, I'll turn to you because I think you were involved at the very beginning of the recognition that there was a problem.
The thing to recall is there are always things killing trees. There are always things killing ohia trees. We had a large amount of ohia die back in the 1970s and the 80s. Since the volcano started erupting, there's a lot of ohia dying of volcanic emissions and drought. We've had a long-term drought. The first time we saw a bunch of trees that were dying that we really didn't know, there was no obvious reason for it, was in 2010 down in Lower Puna. We took some samples. We came up with some diseases, but no diseases that should be killing healthy trees. So we were puzzled about this, but there are a lot of puzzling things in the forest, and we didn't think much of it. We started getting some more complaints in 2011. By 2012, we saw a lot more trees dying. It wasn't just a random occurrence, a lot more trees dying. Again, we took samples in 2012. We did a survey in 2013. We started seeing fairly large numbers of trees dying spread about, mostly centered in Lower Puna. And it wasn't until 2014 that we identified a pathogen. And again, this was a new pathogen. It hadn't turned up in our earlier studies, maybe partly because we weren't looking for the right thing, because it's a new disease. We were looking for the disease we knew, and we found nothing in the earlier things. When we went back to those patches of trees that were dying in 2010, we found the pathogen there. So I think the first trees that I saw that died of this were in 2010, although we didn't identify the disease until 2014.
JB, once you determined that there was, in fact, a problem rather than just random death of trees, which, as you say, happens all the time, what did you actually do at that point once you realized this was a systemic problem that was a lot more widespread than you had initially suspected?
First of all, let me explain the diagnoses. This is mostly what's happening on people's private land. We're bringing in samples to our disease clinic here. Our diagnostician, Brian Bush, diagnosed some normal diseases that you always pick up, nothing that should be killing trees. Then one day he diagnosed this fungus, Ceratocystis. Ceratocystis is a well-known worldwide pathogen, but the first record of it ever having been on ohia. At that point, he said, okay, this is it. This is something big. You need to get some professional pathologist in on it. That's when he recommended we contact Lisa Keith. Then we got the pathologist in on it. We went back. We did systematic sampling, felling a lot of trees, cutting them up, looking for this fungus. And we went back to these areas that we had already recorded trees dying for unknown causes and sampled these. And then time and time again, when we did the sampling, which involved felling the trees, cutting them up, taking diagrams, bringing the samples into lab, then we found this fungus widely distributed in most of these areas that we had seen trees dying that we hadn't had an explanation the year before.
This fungus that you found, does it always kill the tree, or is it possible for the tree to get well?
That's a good question, because our sampling procedure is sampling trees that just died. So if there's a fungus lurking in a tree that isn't causing symptoms, we might not know it.
Flint, I know you have something to add.
Just to clarify, we have never, up to this point, seen a tree recover. Once it shows the symptoms of yellowing to brown leaves, we don't see it recover. We haven't yet.
If people have ohia trees and they see the yellowing to brown, they could suspect they have this. Is that correct? Or could those symptoms be a result of something other than this fungus that is causing rapid ohia death?
There are some symptoms that may be symptoms from some other disease that folks may confuse as rod rapid ohia death, but it's pretty distinctive. You see a quick change from what appears to be a healthy tree to a tree with yellowing leaves to brown leaves within days to weeks. That's quite fast.
There are other things that produce that symptoms if you're just standing on the side of the road looking at it. We've all known for years that if you damage roots of a tree, like you hit it with a bulldozer, it will get infections and then it will often show those symptoms. One of the things that tipped us off and worried us initially about this was these were trees off in the forest that nobody had injured, nobody had damaged, and was still showing this. There are other things that kill trees. I see a lot of a bark canker that one branch will die, but that's just a single branch on a tree. Last year in Kona with all the rain, I saw foliar pathogen, so it was a fungus affecting the leaves, but the tree flushed out again from that. So the leaves, instead of the whole thing turning brown, which is the symptom of the rapid ohia death, the leaves had this kind of patchy fungus on them and eventually fell off and the tree flushed out again. So there are a lot of diseases out there.
Lisa, JB said when he discovered this problem and realized it was something new and different, he contacted you. What did you do at that point, and what are you doing at this point to figure out not only what the problem is, but what a possible solution might be?
Yeah, so I actually remember that call quite well, getting contacted with this list of potential organisms and Ceratocystis being on there, thinking, you know, back from the studies, Dutch elm disease, when I was studying it, I remember it was a Ceratocystis. That was kind of the first clue, wow, this is a potential tree killer. The first thing really was to get a better understanding of the symptoms, but were we going to find this organism always associated with these symptoms? So that was this extensive field sampling, bringing back a lot of samples, trying to isolate the same pathogen. This isn't something we're finding on healthy trees. So the symptoms of almost looking like a drought, but when you start sectioning the tree and the wood, you will somewhere find the discoloration due to the fungus. That is specifically what either Ceratocystis wilt of ohia or ohia wilt or rapid ohia death that most of us have come to know this problem by. That is the distinct difference. From there, it was really trying to isolate a lot of isolates from around the area. The next stage was really to prove the pathogenicity of the fungus, meaning that this fungus is causing rapid ohia death. There are many steps to go through, and some of the work then you do back in the laboratory is taking that fungus in a pure culture, so that's the only thing you're going to actually inject into the seedling. You take healthy seedlings and you try to recreate the symptoms that you're seeing in the field. Some of our initial experiments, the process took much longer. And so we remember going in every day trying to see, is this the day we're going to see the wilt begin? It took a couple months. The plants looked healthy. Then it was that first day where the first branch showed a wilt and then in a couple days died. And then within the week, the rest of the seedling went through that same thing. The leaves from very vibrant green kind of went this dull greenish gray, yellow, brown, and then it was dead. So that really did match what the members of the public were saying. Looking out at these trees, they look healthy, and then within a week or so, it looks dead. The last stage is to do your tree autopsy, your seedling autopsy. You go and section it out. You try to figure out precisely how far this fungus can move, what it's doing inside. When we looked inside, we saw that typical discoloration. Oftentimes with this very aggressive fungus, it produces a starburst pattern. So if you take a cross-section of the trunk, you can see this dark discoloration that radiates out, kind of like a starburst. Then re-isolating that fungus, and you've now proved pathogenicity of this organism. From there, with enough replicates and enough controls to be confident of what we were seeing, then we put together our first paper. It went through peer review for our journal in the end of 2014, published in 2015. So as JB mentioned, this was a new occurrence on the planet. Ohia had never been affected by ceratocystis. So while we could pull some information on similar diseases caused by this fungus and other hosts, we're now embarking on learning as much as we can about our problem here.
That was a huge step forward without any uncertainty to diagnose the pathogen and identify it unequivocally that was the pathogen killing the tree in these instances. Knowing that has helped us immeasurably to begin to figure out, okay, what do we need to do? How do we need to address the spread, the infections, and the mortality that we're seeing? And not knowing what is killing our trees, there's really no way you can come up with a solution. But once we know from Lisa's work what it is, that enables us to now figure out, okay, what do we do now?
And just to remind you, I'm Sherry Brack, and this is Island Issues, and today we're talking about the awful disease, rapid ohia death, with Flint Hughes, who was just talking, J.B. Friday, and Lisa Keith, forestry experts and a plant pathologist who are involved in the fight. Let's get back to it.
So I do want to know what we do now, but first, it sounds to me like the fungus exists for a month, 2 months, and by the time anybody sees anything, they're already past the point of no return, even if there were to be a cure.
Yeah, unfortunately, that is true, and it's probably more like a year or two in the tree. Outwardly, they look fine, and then suddenly they go through this rapid death. And so it is a challenge.
Do we know, out of 800,000 plus acres of ohia here on Hawaii Island, how many acres are already infected with this fungus?
Approximately 35,000 acres of ohia forests have been impacted by the disease, meaning we're seeing significant mortality across those areas. And it's very helpful now to know where those areas are, because now we can get to the business of protecting the areas that have not succumbed to the disease. And there are substantial portions, obviously, of the Big Island where we have not yet seen the mortality. Those are the areas where we need to be partnering with the land managers of those areas to be vigilant about outbreaks of the disease and to aggressively control any outbreaks that do occur. And that means identifying symptomatic trees, cutting them down, or either covering them up or burning if that's possible, so that they do not pose a threat to other trees by way of spreading the spores that they've become infected with.
JB, how old are these trees that are getting infected and dying?
Sometimes the really big and really healthy trees are getting infected. So even in Puna, some of these oldest trees are centuries old. If the disease progresses up into the older forests on Mauna Kea, some of those ohia trees have been estimated to be over 600 years old.
Does this fungus affect other trees other than ohia here on our island?
As of yet, ohia is the only host. We continue to do testing because Ceratocystis fimbriata, the official name of the fungus, does cause disease on a wide variety of agricultural crops.
I think it's important to point out that this is a unique strain that affects the ohia trees. There are other strains of the fungus that affect many other agricultural plants, coffee, cacao, and things like that. Those strains don't affect ohia. The ohia strain does not infect those. It's a separate strain.
Do we know what case zero was? Do we know where this fungus came from on this island, how it got here?
The initial places where we saw this that later we diagnosed the fungus were down in Lower Puna, below Pahoa side, that area. But case zero, no. And case zero could have been many years ago, could have been a decade ago. By the time we noticed trees dying, I mean, there were already hundreds of trees dying. So case zero, no, we don't know. And we probably would never know exactly where the initial one is. Lisa's lab has done the DNA fingerprinting of this strain of fungus. She's compared it with libraries. They have libraries of DNA fingerprints of this fungus around the world. It doesn't match anything. So this is unique. So we don't know exactly what it came in on. If we saw this infected a different plant, then we would know, okay, this must have come in on this plant. We don't know for sure. It's very similar to one on Syngonium, which is a houseplant, but it's not exactly the same. So we're still trying to put together the story on that. It's likely that it either came in on something and was not symptomatic, so it came in on something that didn't show any disease, or that two different strains that are here for other things crossbred and produced a new hybrid that just our luck infected Ohia, or an existing strain that was here on some other plant mutated and jumped to Ohia and became very virulent on Ohia. Unlike a lot of invasive species, we didn't know this was out there. We can't really blame anybody for being careless and bringing in it. I mean, plenty of our invasive species, like little fire ants, coqui frogs, we knew they were out there. We should have done a better job of keeping them out, and we didn't. This one, nobody saw it coming because it was unknown to science before it got here.
You mentioned that there are places on this island where rapid ohia death exists and places that are so far free of it. Where is it? Where is it not?
Initially, we found most of the cases in Lower Puna. By 2015, it spread through the Puna subdivisions as far up as Volcano Village, likewise as far as Tehilo and all the way up the Wailuku watershed, the edge of the Ohia Forest and the pastures. Downwind of that, you find it through Kau up into the Kona Forest, mostly in South Kona, some up in as far as North Kona. So far, we found none in North Hilo, none in Hamakua, none in Kohala.
How does it spread?
There are a lot of different ways that the fungus spreads. A similar strain of Ceratocystis infects oak trees and plane trees on the mainland. That one spreads in root grafting. So root to root, one tree will die and the next tree will die and the next tree will die. This may happen here some, but we don't think it happens very much because we don't see this spreading blotch of 100% dead trees. Mm-hmm. What we see is here's a dead tree, there's another one. Over time, more and more trees in the stand die. One of the ways it spreads is the trees, once they're infected with a fungus, they become very attractive to boring beetles. These standing dead trees just get filled with beetle holes, and the beetles are chewing away at the trees and blowing out all the sawdust. This sawdust carries the disease. The spores are not windblown. The spores are sticky. What they are stuck on is the sawdust that these beetles are producing. So that will blow a mile, 2 miles, a couple miles, and probably in different wind events it'll blow different distances. But we think that is largely one of the important ways that it's spreading. Anecdotally, along with this, is one of the things that we see it spreading kind of downwind from the initial sites. On a longer scale, like how did it jump from Hilo to Kona, that's probably people. So that's where our sanitation program comes in. The easiest way to spread a disease is cut an infected log, bring it over to your place and cut it up with a chainsaw in your yard and blow all that infected sawdust out into your forest. So people moving around Ohia, especially Ohia wood, are one way that we're sure that it's spreading, and that's why our public information campaign is don't move Ohia around. It makes all the sense in the world to see a dead tree. Well, I need some firewood and bring it up somewhere else and cut it up. Cutting up the wood will spread infected sawdust, will spread the disease.
So it has to be cut up, meaning if I brought a pre-cut Ohia log that was infected to my house, but I didn't cut it up, am I safe?
No. First of all, it's not a good idea. And second, the fungus, it would attract beetles. So then the beetles blow out more sawdust, or the beetles themselves might be carrying it place to place. And then anything that you're touching or touches that log and then touches some other tree, especially if the tree has a wound. This fungus enters the tree through a wound, and we got to thinking, how many trees in Big Island have wounds? Well, Hurricane Azelle snapped a little branch or two off almost every tree around, so almost every tree is susceptible. So just not moving the pathogen around, not moving infected Ohia trees around, especially wood, is the best way. The fungus is in the wood. So seedlings, Ohia seedlings, potted plants could also be something that are very likely to move it around.
How about the flowers and how about soil?
The fungus has not been found typically in flowers and other plants. So it's in the xylem, it's in the wood. Now, when you're picking for flowers, we don't know how thin a branch it could be in, so there you're cutting it really close. Well, if I pinch off a flower, but if I clip off a flower, maybe I'm spreading it. That's really close. So really just avoiding doing that is the best thing to do it. In these infected forests, the trees are full of beetles chewing away at the infected trees. The trees are falling down on the ground. If you take soil samples in these infected forests, Lisa's lab has found about 1 out of 20, about 5% of them are infected. So if you drive your truck through these forests and get it all full of soil and then drive it off somewhere else and knock the dirt out from the tires when you're in a different forest, that's a way of spreading the disease. So soil from infected forests is likely contaminated with contaminated sawdust and could spread the disease.
The fungus produces spores that kind of have this hardened jacket they can survive a variety of environmental conditions. So when it comes to wood, even cut up wood, a year, maybe 2 years, the fungus can actually remain alive. And same thing when it comes to infected soil, at least half a year to a year. If this comes into contact with ohia, with a wound, there is the potential to cause a new problem.
One of the things that Lisa's found out is that you can kill it by heating it. And so kiln-dried lumber, the drying process and the heating process in a kiln will kill the fungus. Just air-dried lumber won't be. So kiln-dried lumber will not be infectious, and that can be shipped. If you buy kiln-dried ohia flooring, you're not moving the disease around. Posts, on the other hand, posts are not kiln-dried. The center of that post can very much be infectious, as well as firewood. Those are both things that could very well spread the disease, and we encourage people not to move around.
In terms of trying to manage the spread of the disease in forests, what's become really important is trying to stop that cycle of frass production.
Could you define frass?
Oh, frass is the sawdust that JB was describing. It can be as fine as talcum powder. So when you're thinking about how easily that could be spread in the winds, talcum powder could blow miles and miles under the right conditions. If we are to protect our remaining forests, it will mean trying to reduce that frass load. Get to infected trees before the insects begin to bore in and create frass. That's where we really need to mobilize our control efforts.
Is there a cure for this rapid ohia death or any way to mitigate?
I think the focus is, can we manage? Can we slow down? Can we stop the spread? It hasn't spread to any of the other islands. Part of the credit goes to the Hawaii Department of Agriculture's quarantine. As soon as they learned about this disease, they instituted a quarantine of no shipping ohia products to other islands unless it's inspected and found to be disease-free. So they really jumped on this quickly. We have been analyzing dozens of samples of suspected disease from the other islands. None of them have been positive. So that bit of management has been successful. What we're thinking of is in these areas that are not infected, especially some of these really nice ohia forests, if we see it starting on the borders of that, cut down trees, knock them down, cover them up so the beetles don't produce this frass, the beetles themselves aren't flying, to try to stop the disease from getting into these high-value and pristine forests.
And that process is going to involve frequent surveying of our healthy forests, looking diligently for symptomatic trees, getting out there to test them and or cut them down right there on the spot. So that, again, we can try to break that frass, that sawdust production cycle. That's certainly true for the other islands. The state is in the process of setting up regular surveys, looking for outbreaks, and preparing themselves to go in and control those trees as quickly as possible. Kohala is another perfect example of that. Kohala, fortunately, right now is kind of an island of forest health with regard to rapid ohia death. We don't have it up there. We need to be very vigilant in our surveying and very proactive in getting out to suspicious-looking trees. If they turn out to be positive for the disease, cutting them down before they begin to produce that frass that we're so worried about.
So when you talk about testing the tree, I got the sense from Lisa that the way you test the tree is you cut it in half, and by then the tree's dead anyway. So you can, what, take a branch of the tree, cut it off, and test it to determine if it actually has it? So there is a way to save the tree?
Initial testing really was the entire tree autopsy, really looking for that discoloration, and that's what's key for identification of the fungus, either the truly discolored area or very close to it. We've developed some rapid molecular techniques, meaning now we can pick up the DNA, so it's even more sensitive in a way even to your eye, but it's still a challenge to find that right sample. Some of it is more of a slash, lateral cut. We've also utilized drilling. It's very critical, though, to sanitize whatever tools we're working with, especially when you're working with DNA. It's very easy to carry it over and get contamination. With the new testing method, within 24 hours, we really can detect the pathogen if it's present. So that's been very helpful when it comes to looking at these off-island samples, potential shipping samples, you know, for permits for HDOA. But it is a challenge. Sometimes you feel like you're trying to find the needle in a haystack of that fungus in the tree. So I think when it comes to sampling, and particularly in areas where it hasn't been detected before or particularly off island, it's going to be critical to properly diagnose it and to catch it and really minimize any spread in these new areas. And that takes you back to more extensive sampling.
But it sounds like from what you all have said that the step today is control, that there is no cure. And the question, Lisa, you're the doctor, the plant doctor, is it likely we're going to find a cure that would stop it in its tracks?
Unfortunately, an absolute cure, no. And this is well known, studying these diseases caused by this fungus around the world.
The cure and the way we're going to save our forests are by really becoming proactive in controlling the spread of the disease. That includes the sanitation, the quarantine, and then this very, very vigilant and aggressive control of diseased trees. You know, the disease in Pune, unfortunately, became widespread before we knew really what was happening. But now that we know, we are now armed with the ability to control it in a much better fashion. And so really putting in these control measures is going to take support and coordination of agencies and local, state, and national organizations to support this effort.
I guess, unfortunately, with invasive species, particularly an invasive fungus, sometimes the darkest days are when it first begins. And it seems to wreak havoc. But I think still hope exists that even in the worst hit areas now, there are trees that have survived. So that's another big issue, really trying to figure out, okay, did they escape and they eventually will die? Or even better, are there sources of resistance that can then be further tested and studied and then multiplied and either saving seed, vegetatively propagating it, and being able to either reforest, replant areas, or actually find varieties or species that show more resistance to this problem?
A lot of what you've talked about is land owned by the state, the county, federal government, big conservation groups. What about the individual homeowner?
The first thing to do is try to determine whether or not it in fact has the disease. That means, particularly if you're in an area where we have not seen the disease manifesting itself very much, getting it tested. So calling one of us, getting us out there to sample the tree, bring that sample back to Lisa's lab so that we can test it.
And so you don't recommend that individual homeowners would then cut off a branch individually?
It's better to get assistance and at least some detailed advice about how best to do that. If the diagnosis is, yes, the tree has the disease, the best thing to do is get the tree down on the ground, cut it down and either cover it up or burn it in order to stop the beetles getting to the tree, producing the frass, which is then going to increase the spread of the spores across the local and maybe regional landscapes.
JB, how should people get a hold of you?
Actually, the best way to get hold of me is through my email, jbfriday@hawaii.edu. My phone is 808-969-8254. Shooting an email is better. That's jbfriday@hawaii.edu. So what we're concentrating on, again, though, is seeing where is it spreading? Is it spreading to new areas? If there's a landowner with a likely infected tree in Kohala, for example, we definitely would get out there to sample because we would want to take action. If it's an infected tree in one of the Pune subdivisions that we know that there are thousands and thousands of infected trees there, we'd be happy to explain to the homeowner what to do about it. But following up every of the thousands of spots here, that's just beyond what we're able to do. And I do want to stress that be safe about these things. If it's a hazard tree, like it's a tree that's going to fall in your house or the electrical wires, get a professional to take it down. And with fire, smoke and burning will not spread the fungus. Be careful setting fires. Our website is rapidohiadeath.org. We put updates on that as we find it. We update maps of where we have found the disease and then updates what we're learning about the disease.
Is there sufficient funding for the research that has to be done and for the work that you all are doing? Because it sounds like, JB, for example, you actually did have a job before Rapid Ohia Death came along. So is there adequate funding? Are we on the federal and state level doing the right thing at this point?
We are doing as much as we can right now with the resources we have. We have obtained a lot of support, which is a testament to how concerned people are, both private citizens, agencies, etc. And we are moving as quickly as we can, both on the research front and the management front. We could be moving more quickly with more resources, absolutely.
We appreciate the private foundations as well as agency in-kind support. The U.S. Forest Service has drummed up a lot of in-kind support of things with us. Our critical thing, I think, right now is continuing that. We have a number of the grants that were 1 year, and so we're staffing up, we're hiring people, we're getting things launched, but you can't do that much with 1 year if it eclipses. So our push now is to get something that is more sustained funding. This is a problem that will be here for the rest of our careers. This is not something that we'll cure, take care of, and go away. So long-term management on this, long-term research on this is something that people are going to be working on for decades now. So we need sustained funding. There's a substantial legislative appropriation now to the state DLNR for working on this problem. And I think the entire Big Island delegation, although the legislatures have been supporting this. So we're very appreciative of that. We have had enormous help from the state. I mean, I'm with the university, so we're part of the state. But both the Division of Land and Natural Resources, Forestry and Wildlife, and Hawaii Department of Agriculture have been working together really well. And watershed partnerships, which are private-public partnerships, have been absolutely critical in being on the lookout for this. The invasive species committees on each island, the Voldman on top of it, doing surveys, getting us samples, informing their community members about it.
The website, rapidohiadeath.org, really is good. It has tons of resources. It has the names, addresses, and photographs of these three people that I've been with this morning. Is there anything else the public needs to know before we say aloha? JB Friday.
We're also on Facebook, so Facebook Rapid Ohia Death.
Just to add, if we don't do anything, we know from our research that we can expect to see, on average, a quarter of our ohia trees in our forest perish each year.
Then in 4 years, we have no ohia forest at all.
That's in infected areas where the disease is present. Once it becomes established, it's very hard to control. That's why I'm emphasizing controlling those outbreak areas in otherwise healthy forests. That's why it's so critical.
I'd like to thank Lisa Keith, J.B. Friday, and Flint Hughes for all of your time, sharing all of your mana'o, and just remind everybody, it's up to us to be on the lookout. Thank you so much. Aloha.
Thank you.
Aloha, mahalo.
Thank you very much.
I'm Sherry Bracken. This is Island Issues. I'll see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us info@lava1053.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.